So long as that they can kill you and then write the story, that's exactly what they'll do.
A glimpse inside the mind of the Fairbanks militia leader. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 23rd of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a family in Bethel has unanswered questions after a police officer killed their dog.
I said, you know, I need to know, was she shot? And very reluctantly, he said, yes. So I said, well, I want to know what happened.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska Susitna Borough.
Five members of a Fairbanks militia group have pleaded not guilty to an array of state charges, including conspiracy to commit murder and kidnapping and weapons misconduct. Peacemakers militia leader Francis Schaefer Cox and members Coleman Barney, Michael Anderson, and Lonnie and Karen Vernon allegedly stockpiled weapons as part of a retaliatory plot against judges and state troopers they felt threatened or wronged by. Prior to their March 10th arrest, Schaefer Cox was a fugitive, resisting a minor weapons charge, and the Vernons were fighting the IRS over income taxes. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the group of militia members shared an ideology that denies the legitimacy of government based on their interpretation of a strict adherence to the Constitution.
Schaefer Cox went on the lam after receiving a court order last month barring him from using a constitutional defense for a 2010 misdemeanor weapons misconduct charge. That undercut Cox's fundamental belief that we are sovereign people only bound by common or natural law.
It's as simple as two laws. Do all you've agreed to do and don't encroach on other people in their territory. All those are universally accepted by everybody.
That's Cox speaking at a press conference in Fairbanks this past November. The 27-year-old founder of the Peacemakers Militia and Second Amendment Task Force turned his back on mainstream politics after losing a state house race in 2008. He gained national attention advocating for constitutionalism, an ideology founded on the belief that we rule our own lives and are free from post-Constitution created statutes. Speaking in November, he said his pursuit of freedom resulted in bogus charges, harassment, and threats from authorities.
Anytime that there's an individual or a group of individuals that are either scratching the surface of the stuff that they don't want you to know, or that are gaining enough momentum to be actually able to say no thank you to the tyranny, they want to come in and splinter that and fragment that. And a big Ruby Ridge shootout with me and my wife would be enough to splinter that, or at least that was their hopes. I would hope that this is about ideas and not about a man, and I think it would continue on. But I don't want to be dead and finding out from the other side.
Charging documents allege that at the time of Cox's November comments, he and fellow militia members were already beginning to prepare for violence. But at the November event, Cox said he wasn't instigating it.
I don't want to start a war, and these guys are going to fly up here. They're going to whip us up into a big bloody frenzy, and then they're going to fly on to the next town, and we're going to be left here torn in half. And we need to not be suckered into this big old shootout. Now, we've been kind of quiet and living on the run, but the longer we're quiet about what's actually happening here and all of this, these character assassinations and real assassination attempts that have been going on, the more bold they're going to be. Because so long as that they can kill you and then write the story, that's exactly what they'll do.
The case against Cox and the other militia members, who are also facing federal charges, hinges on secret recordings of their conversations. But a member of the militia says only a faction of the group was involved in the alleged plot. Gary Brockman says the Peacemakers Militia began with good intentions to protect innocent people, but evolved into a personal army for Cox. He says the militia only had about 25 to 30 active members, not the 3,500 Cox talked about, but that the power went to Cox's head. Brockman, who attended militia meetings into February, says Cox and the faction who, quote, took a wrong turn, kept any violent plans from the larger group, but that given what's happened, the Peacemakers Militia is defunct. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Congressman Don Young is being called out for ties to Schaefer Cox. Young attended a Second Amendment Task Force Open Carry Day event in Fairbanks in April 2009. A post on the Southern Poverty Law Center website says Young, who's also a National Rifle Association board member, signed a letter of declaration written by Cox that pledges to abolish a government that seeks to further tax, restrict, or register firearms. The post says Young spokeswoman Meredith Kenney replied to a query about the connection with Cox by saying the congressman has absolutely no affiliation with Mr. Cox and that he attended solely as a staunch defender of the Second Amendment. She went on to say that the letter the congressman signed expresses the view that we should elect those who will defend the Constitution and in turn the Second Amendment as written or vote them out of power. A military judge has sentenced a soldier from Wasilla to 24 years in prison for his role in a conspiracy with fellow soldiers that led to the murders of three unarmed Afghan civilians. The decision by Lieutenant Colonel Kwasi Hawks today comes after Specialist Jeremy Morlock pleaded guilty to three counts of murder and one count each of conspiracy, obstructing justice, and illegal drug use at his court-martial at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. The judge said he intended to sentence Morlock to life in prison with possibility of parole, but he was bound by a plea deal that called for a maximum sentence of 24 years. The 22-year-old Morlock is one of five soldiers from the 5th Stryker Brigade charged in the 2010 killings of the Afghan men in Kandahar province. He was the first to be court-martialed. In his plea deal, Morlock said he and others slaughtered the three civilians, knowing that they were unarmed and posed no legitimate threat. He also described taking a lead role in the January incident, lobbing a grenade at the civilian while another soldier shot at him and then lying about it to his squad leader. 1 year after President Obama signed the sweeping Health Care Act into law, Alaska's Republican governor is continuing his fight against it. Governor Sean Parnell is moving forward to implement one part of the law, but on the state's own terms and at its own expense. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Governor Parnell's decision last month to turn away $1 million in federal money raised ire and disgust from state Democrats. The money would have gone towards setting up a state-run health insurance exchange program where Alaskans could learn about which insurance is available to them. Parnell says the state will set up its own exchange, just on its own terms. In fact, in an interview Wednesday, Parnell's Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Bill Strewer, complimented the idea of an exchange program.
I think the benefits are fairly clearly outlined in the legislation and in the Affordable Care Act itself. But for Alaskans, it's going to give them a one-stop shop to go in and look at different health insurance plans that may be available on the market. And to look at it from a single point, to have a peer navigator who can walk them through the process and negotiate the morass of health insurance.
Strewer says despite thinking the insurance exchange is a good idea, the Parnell administration won't take the free federal money because the governor fundamentally does not agree the federal government should be involved. However, if the state does not come up with a plan by 2013 to start an insurance exchange, the federal government will swoop in and take it over. Strewer says it should not come to that, though. He's confident the state can set one up. And he wants to make sure it helps not only Alaskan patients, but also insurance companies.
I'm concerned that the health insurance exchange will be treading on the health insurance market in some ways that could become very painful to them. And we want to involve the insurance brokers, the insurance companies, and others in the development of this to make sure that we do it so that everybody benefits.
The Obama administration says customers and patients, not insurance companies, need the bulk of assistance. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius explained Wednesday what would happen if a state fails to set up an exchange.
The law provides that the Department of Health and Human Services would set up an exchange, a competitive market where small business owners, entrepreneurs who buy insurance on their own, could have a larger pool and at least two or three plans to choose from in a competitive market, and that they could not be eliminated from that market because of pre-existing health conditions.
A number of states are challenging the health care law, but Alaska is at the lead of some of the fights. Despite that, Sebelius spoke with Governor Parnell this week.
Alaska is, I think, the only state in the country at this point who has decided that they will not make themselves eligible for the federal funding that is in place to help states do a better job with regulating insurance companies. So states have been able to add staff and look more closely at the rates companies charge.
Sebelius says rejecting the money is the governor's prerogative, and the state can successfully forge its own version of a health exchange as long as one does get created.
But Governor Parnell assured me that they fully intend in Alaska to set up an exchange so that the citizens who live there will have access to more affordable coverage and more choices. He said that some of what I read in the paper is probably a little bit exaggerated.
Sebelius talked to reporters Wednesday to tout the health care law on its one-year anniversary. The former governor of Kansas says it especially helps rural Americans by increasing payments to rural providers and training doctors to serve in remote areas. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Barrow residents argue against endangered species protections for ringed and bearded seals.
You don't have any information whether seal numbers are increasing or decreasing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
A family in Bethel is looking for answers after their dog was shot and killed by an off-duty police officer. Bethel's city manager says he's called for a full investigation into the matter. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
Corey Popple had three dogs, but her favorite was her all-white Bethel mutt named Lady.
The kids in the neighborhood called her Diamond. They would walk by and play with her when we used to chain her up out front, and just loved her to death, and she loves the kids.
Lady was a medium-sized dog, about 30 pounds, and smaller than Popple's two labs that surround her as she talks about the time she adopted Lady off the streets of Bethel.
Her poor ribs were sticking out. She was so skinny.
That was about a year ago. Since then, Lady became part of the family, which includes Popple's husband and 10-year-old daughter. Popple says that Lady's time on the street made her weary of adults.
She was pretty aloof from people. She wouldn't let anybody near her. She wouldn't go near anybody. She was very smart. Stray dog.
Popple says last Tuesday, Lady got loose after she broke the clasp on her chain at their home on 4th Road, Tundra Ridge. Later that day, she got a call from a community service officer that informed her that Lady was dead and that he had removed her body from the street in front of her house.
I asked what had happened, thinking maybe she had gotten hit by a car. And I said, you know, I need to know, was she shot? And very reluctantly, he said yes. So I said, well, I want to know what happened.
She says she spoke with Lieutenant Andrea Shea, who told her that an off-duty officer had killed Lady.
It was his understanding that my dog had attacked an officer's little girl, and then he said stepdaughter, and had torn her coat, and the officer feared for his daughter's safety and fired his weapon. So me thinking, oh my God, my dog hurt somebody. I said, I need proof. I need to know what injuries this girl had. I need to see the coat. I need to see my dog. I want to see fibers in her mouth. I want proof that my dog attacked this little girl.
KYUK has made repeated calls to the Bethel police, but they have not returned our calls. Popple asked the city to return her dog's body to her, but she says that was not possible.
They said that she's in the dump and there's no way they can give her back to us, so we can't even bury her after just throwing her away with the trash.
Lady was wearing a bright pink collar when she was killed, according to Popple. She says she went to the Bethel City manager, Lee Foley, with her questions. As he looked into it, he says that the story from the off-duty officer changed. Parts of it, anyway. The part where Lady attacked the little girl.
That particular incident with the little girl had happened a week before, and they don't even know whose dog it was that attacked the little girl. It could have been the Papiles, but it could not have been. In any case, it was not the white dog that was ultimately shot.
Last weekend, the Bethel police issued a press release. There, they said the dog was pursuing the off-duty officer that morning by barking and nipping at his ankles. They say the officer tried to push the dog away, but it became more aggressive. Fearing he might get bit, he shot it. The city is not releasing the name of the officer, but Foley says he has called for a full investigation of the incident.
The best thing we can do is to investigate it fully and make sure that everything, all the proper procedures and everything was done that was supposed to be done and was done correctly, and if it wasn't, to ensure that it never happens like that again.
Foley adds that any dog that is killed is buried as quickly as possible for health and safety reasons. He says that Lady was buried the way most dogs are, wrapped in a blanket, sealed in a plastic bag, and placed in her own hole. After that, it's usually covered with other junk, like everything else at the dump. Foley says after he was contacted by Popple, he tasked city workers with trying to locate Lady, but they were unable to. Corey Popple says she and her husband tried to do the same thing, but they too could not find her. Popple says at this point she wants proof that her dog was in the wrong, and if not, she would like a public apology from the police department. Foley says he will release the findings of the investigation to her family once it is complete. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Federal officials are on the North Slope collecting input from residents about the proposed listing of certain ice-dependent seals as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration held a public meeting in Barrow last night, and testimony was overwhelmingly critical of the proposed listing. KBRW's Jake Neer has the story.
44 people attended a meeting put on by NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service Tuesday night to voice their opinions about applying Endangered Species Act protection to three species of ring seals and two populations of bearded seal. NOAA fisheries officials say the proposed threatened listing was sparked by a petition from the Center for Biological Diversity and is based on long-term model projections showing sea ice and snow cover loss. But that justification came under severe scrutiny at Tuesday's meeting at the Inupiat Heritage Center in Barrow from nearly every speaker. North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta led off testimony.
You don't have any information whether seal numbers are increasing or decreasing. You don't know the movement pattern of the animals. You don't know how they use the habitat. You don't know how the snow will change as the ice continues to thin and retreat.
Mayor Itta went on to say Endangered Species Act protections are not an effective tool to address climate change, the actual cause of the projected sea ice loss. This was a concern brought up numerous times during the night, including during the testimony of wildlife biologist Robert Sudam.
There are millions of ring seals and probably hundreds of thousands of bearded seals. In my mind, the ESA was never intended to protect species that have such large population sizes. So help the credibility and future usefulness of the Endangered Species Act by not listing ringed and bearded seals.
Another major concern expressed during testimony Tuesday was that projections would negatively impact local residents, especially the Inupiaq population and their subsistence lifestyle, far more than they would positively protect seal populations. Barrow resident Ethel Putkatuk said she believes the added regulations are a slap in the face.
My friend Richard Glenn sat down and looked at the number of federal statutes and Alaska statutes that circumscribe our lives and concluded quite rightly that we are becoming the most fundamentally regulated people on the face of this planet. We who do the least damage that we can to the environment, we who only try only to use what hunt and gather what we need.
NOAA fisheries officials and environmental groups maintain the Endangered Species Act is set up to protect subsistence users, and this listing would not impact their way of life, Moreover, they point to additional protections in the Marine Mammals Protection Act that also maintain exemptions for traditional hunting. However, those opposed to the proposal are concerned about the one exception to those protections, that subsistence harvest cannot be wasteful. That's a term that some speakers called subjective and arbitrary. Barrow resident Joe Sage says the oversight that provision requires has impacted hunters in the recent past.
That's like me walking with you through AC Valley Center. Hey, well, hold on 1 second. Can I check your pockets? What did you get? What did you get to eat? Are you sure you're going to eat that? That's how we feel.
NOAA officials at the meeting said they'd take all testimony into careful consideration and acknowledge that traditional knowledge should play a part in the final decision. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Alaska searchers say a 45-year-old pilot has been found alive days after he took off from Anchorage's Lake Hood float plane port without filing a flight plan. John Burrick, a special agent with the U.S. Forest Service, was found by searchers just before 1 p.m. today at the site of his crashed plane in the Beluga Lake area, about 65 miles from Anchorage. Alaska National Guard spokesman Major Guy Hayes says Burrick was not injured. Hayes says Burrick told rescuers he crashed his Piper Super Cub after taking off Sunday. Forest Service spokesman Ray Massey says co-workers of Burrick did not become concerned until Tuesday because he often works outside the Anchorage office. Joe Miller has a new job. The former Republican U.S. Senate candidate from Fairbanks has been hired to chair the Western Representation Political Action Committee. The conservative Nevada-based PAC helped finance Miller's 2010 primary win over Lisa Murkowski. Miller says the job entails the full range of political advocacy.
Identifying, evaluating races throughout the country in which there is a Tea Party or constitutional conservative that's thrown his or her hat in the ring. Determine whether or not that's a race we want to get involved in, raise money to support the candidacy, not just make the public endorsement, but also get on the ground in those locations and campaign. We'll also probably encourage people to get into races that we believe there is a chance that a constitutional conservative could win in. So really this is about strategizing. It's about getting active in races, raising funds, and ourselves, boots on the ground, getting involved in the races.
Miller says Fairbanks will remain his primary residence, but that the new job will involve a lot of travel. Western Representation PAC co-founder Roger Stockton says Miller is a good fit for his organization.
His commitment to the same values that we have, fiscal responsibility, limiting, you know, government intrusion into the private sector, and his resume, you know, as a former judge, he's a constitutional scholar, a West Point graduate. He brings a lot of experience and knowledge to our team.
Stockton says he and his son formed the Western Representation PAC in 2009 out of concern for where the country was headed financially. Congressman Don Young says this month's ruling by a federal judge reinstating the roadless rule in the Tongass would most likely prevent the development of future hydroelectric projects in much of Southeast. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, Young made the statement during a community roundtable in Ketchikan today.
Earlier this month, U.S. District Court Judge John Sedgwick reinstated roadless rural protections for the Tongass, siding with a coalition of environmental groups, tourism businesses, and the organized village of Cake. Since that time, Southeast leaders have been working to determine whether the court decision would prevent them from moving forward with a bevy of hydro projects in the planning stages. City of Ketchikan Mayor Lou Williams III says the city is waiting to hear whether its planned Whitman Lake hydroelectric project would be affected.
We want to start working on that next year, and we have the permits and everything, but if they're going to all of a sudden now change and say we can't because of the role of this, we've got a real issue.
City Manager Carl Lamelon, who also manages Ketchikan Public Utilities, says the city has been in contact with the Forest Service about the roadless court ruling.
We haven't been able to get a definitive answer out of the Forest Service as to whether or not we're going to be able to move that project forward.
The Forest Service confirmed Wednesday that the agency has not determined whether hydro projects would be affected by the court ruling. Erin Uloth is the spokesperson for the Tongass National Forest.
It's understandable that folks are frustrated. And I want to say that it's taking us a while because we want to get it right. We don't have experience with this issue in Alaska. We've been under an exemption for a long time, and so we don't want to be changing information midstream.
Young says he believes that the recent court ruling would likely prevent most planned hydro projects in the region. Young says he would use a threat of federal funding cuts to see that the hydro projects move forward.
We do have the purse strings, and I will say that we should be able to ask them respectfully in the cases of hydropower to allow that those projects to go forth. They may not agree, but then what we have to do is just whack their money, and maybe they get a little more interest if that happens.
The Clinton-era roadless rule prohibits logging and road building in unroaded portions of the Tongass. The rule does, however, allow some logging in roadless areas for utility corridors. Still, Southeast Alaska Power Agency Executive Director Dave Carlson says he believes the court ruling would effectively halt most hydro projects.
The judge's decision exempts transmission lines. I don't think it exempts hydro. And certainly the current Obama administration has an interpretation that includes hydro projects as roadless. So obviously there is conflict between the judge's decision and the Obama administration.
Carlson says most of the region's hydro projects are in roadless areas. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Jake Neer in Barrow, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. What does an Athabascan artist, the teenage creator of a statewide energy campaign, and a National Geographic photographer have in common? A passion for Alaska and a Conservation Achievement Award from the Alaska Conservation Foundation. Nominate someone you know who's working to ensure a healthy Alaska for an ACF Conservation Achievement Award. Information available online at alaskaconservation.org. The deadline is March 31st. This message sponsored by the Alaska Conservation Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.